This is Russell Thompson and Nev Jones, recorded at Peterhouse College, Cambridge, on the 15th of September 2007 by Chris Alden Lee. Russell Thompson and Nev Jones.
Well, I'm Russell Thompson, and I was born in Neath, South Wales, on the 16th of June 1937.
And I'm Nev Jones, also a Welshman, but from North Wales, just to balance him up. And my birth was the birthday was 13th of February 36.
And you were born in?
In Bethesda, in North Wales.
Mm. I'm from Shrewsbury, so I know Bethesda.
Oh, are you? Right, yeah. Okay.
What were you doing before Bass?
Well, I went straight on to FIDS or Bass from university. It was my first job. In fact, interestingly, one of my lecturers at Swansea was Derek Mailing, who was down with Dick Laws at the three-man party at the end of the 40s. And he was lecturing in cartography at Swansea. And over the 3 years, I used to borrow his diaries and photographs, and I got really turned on with FIDS. And so at the end of my degree, I applied and went straight down to Antarctica from Swansea via the Met Office Training School in London.
So you were recruited by the Antarctic as a teenager?
Mainly through Derek's diaries and photographs. I mean, I used to read Scott and Shackleton as a schoolboy, but when I was exposed to the real Antarctica with Derek's diaries and photographs, it really... In fact, I applied in the end of my second year. I was so keen to go down. But Fitz said, no, hold on, get your degree first and then head south. And that's what I did. So I graduated in July 58, and I went down on the Shackleton in October 1958.
Well, was it the work that made you want to go, or the environment?
The environment, really, and the way of life. It just appealed to my sort of exploring instincts, really. And it was the science, but the way of life was more important, chance to travel and visit this rather unique part of the world.
How about you, Nev?
Well, I'm a biologist, and I didn't really build up to this very quickly. I remember being very impressed with the book on the crossing of Antarctica, and the photographs and so on in there really made me think I'd quite like to see some of that.
Fuchs?
This is Fuchs and Hillary, yeah. And that was 57, 58. And then I went, did my first degree in zoology, then I did teacher training. But before going into teaching, I'd heard Bill Sloman coming round on his recruiting round. And I decided I would apply before settling down to teach. And they had one job as a biologist. I applied, but I didn't get it. But they then said, but if you'd like to go as a Metman, we'll give you a crash course in meteorology.
We all did, yeah.
So I thought, right, that'll do me.
This crash course, how effective was it?
Well, it allowed me to know what a cloud was, you know, different types of clouds or whatever. But I had to learn really on the job as to the heights and things, because they're different down there from up here. But I was just a Met assistant. I wasn't forecasting or anything like that. So I was doing a bit of biology on the side.
So you both worked side by side in meteorology?
Well, I went down with some meteorology. I was doing a degree in geography at Swansea. I had done meteorology and climatology and geomorphology, so I had some inkling. I still went to the Air Ministry Training School, and the most invaluable part of that was repairing instruments, because I knew that, you know, we'd need to be doing them on a regular basis. So in those days, they took virtually anybody as a Met assistant, because these days you have to be a professional meteorologist. So I was a geographer with a BSc in physical geography. Nev was a zoologist. And other people without degrees were taken on as Met assistants, really. If you were, you know, had some common sense and could recognize, you know, the clouds in the sky, I suppose that was your big qualification. The training school was a bit of a joke, really, wasn't it? It was only about six, 7 weeks.
It sounds as if you had a full course, and yeah. I didn't, because I can't remember fixing anything much.
But did you actually go then to an outstation? I went to Cardiff Airport for 5 weeks, some outstation routine, which was very helpful again. So I suppose it was quite thorough. But
Which accounts for mine being a crash course, which was a shorter and sharper one, I think. Mm.
Your prime purpose then as a meteorologist was just observation, or were you doing some forecasting as well?
No, yeah, we were basically assistants, observers.
Yes, just observing, recording, and sending them off to the Falklands. And there was a forecaster in South Georgia.
Yes, and also the chief med officer in Stanley used to send the forecast down to the bases, and at least we did plot them up, didn't we, on sort of crude synoptic charts. So we had some forecasting skill, but it was very generalised. So we did the Met, and then we all had a hobby. Nev was, she spilled, and I was studying the Orwell Glacier around the corner, a glaciology project. So we were primarily Met assistants, Met observers, really, rather than, we weren't meteorologists.
So the Met work was a bread and butter, but then you had other passions.
Yes.
You were studying sheath bills, is that right?
Well, I ended up studying sheath bills, yes, because the operation, obviously, on Fitz's part was that they were getting two jobs for the price of one, in a sense, weren't they?
Yeah.
I was actually supposed to be trying to develop the insects and mites and little things like that, because the main birds and seals and so on had already had some attention, but some of this little stuff was what I was really interested in anyway. Because I was an agricultural zoology, which is a lot about pests and things. So this seemed to me to fit in quite nicely. So I started to do that, but I ended up in my first base, which is Admiralty Bay, where you couldn't find an insect at all because there was no vegetation or anything there at that time. And then I moved up to South Georgia for the summer to assist a guy from Birmingham who was doing mosses, Stanley Green. And there, of course, there were lots of stuff. Then I came back down to Sydney for my second winter. And at that time, Roger Filer had died there, having started to lay the foundations of a study of the sheathbill. So I also knew by this time that proper biologists were coming down, that is, I mean, full-timers, the following year with Martin Holgate. And one of them was going to be an entomologist anyway. So he would be full-time, and I was just collecting. So I decided, I think there's a lot more to be gained by doing the bird work and finishing Roger's base, build on Roger's foundations. And so I spent my last summer doing that study on the sheathbill.
Because Roger died in his second year, so he had 1 year's field work under his belt before he died. And I was on base in the night that Roger died. And so when Nev came down, he was the ideal person to continue Roger's project, really.
What sort of impact did Roger's death have on you?
Well, I'd had two earlier. I was at Admiralty Bay before Sydney, and I had two deaths on Admiralty Bay. So when I left Admiralty Bay to get away from the atmosphere, blow me down, within 2 months, we had lost Roger on Goulet in Sydney. And it's devastating because, you know them so well down there. And even when I talk about it now, still Philip, 40-odd years later, it's amazing, because to lose three in two winters was tough. And the empty bunk would haunt you for a long, long while afterwards. And it really took the icing off the cake in that respect.
Would there have been, just talking that subject generally, the three incidences, would there have been some kind of practice or procedure that the FIDs who survived would observe the missing person laying the plate at table or something?
No, all we did was carefully make an inventory of the dead person's possessions and pack them up and send them back to their parents or next of kin. And the bunk was left empty. I remember on Admiralty Bay, Tink was on the bunk opposite me. And Tinkerbell, he was the one down a crevasse on July 1950-59. And his bunk, nobody dared move into his bunk after that, so it was left empty for the rest of the winter.
Respect or superstition?
Oh, I think it was basically respect, really. It was his bunk, and he was a tremendous character. I remember one night on Met Obs, I was up at 3 o'clock to do the Met Obs, and Tink was up from 12 until 3, and he'd found a Met balloon, and he'd painted a ghouly face on it and put a light bulb inside the Met balloon and hung it on the bottom of my bed. So when I woke up, I saw the ghastly red apparition there. And he was a tremendous, tremendous character.
Just give me his name again.
This is Dennis Bell, and we called him Tinkerbell. And the first one was Alan Sharman, and I was involved with that. I was out walking with Alan, and we had a fall, and I walked away. He didn't. And then Roger Filer was the one on Sydney in February 1961.
Stop me if you don't want to answer these questions. Is there any kind of sense of inappropriate guilt after somebody's been killed? The rest of you think we're lucky to be alive?
Well, not really. I felt guilty, the first one, with Alan, because I was with him, and we were going... We'd been around the beach Sunday afternoon stroll. We had taken two dogs, and we're coming back over the peninsula at Admiralty Bay to do an ice off, and it got pretty steep and pretty icy, and the dogs began sliding and slithering, and we got towards the top. It got very icy. Alan was an experienced mountaineer, RAF mountain rescue team, and I think what happened, the dog slipped and knocked Alan off balance. And I can still hear him shouting, "Save me," as he sort of careered and his head first down the rocks. And I panicked and went down after him, and I landed up literally alongside his pulverized head. It gave me nightmares. So I felt guilty that I had gone down my backside, and I was nearly 18 stone then, so I had a lot of blubber to go down on. And poor Alan had come down head first and hadn't survived. So I felt guilty that I had survived and not Alan.
After an event like that, it takes a long time for things to return to normal as a group,
is it? No, it's amazingly... No, you were in South Georgia when Roger died. But it's amazing, looking at my diary, you know, the shock of the day itself and the next few days, and then the burial. And then you have to be resilient and get back to normal. You can't harbour any grief, really, because it's a lonely, lonely outpost down there. So it's surprisingly quickly you do get back to normal and back to the routine things. And you don't learn by the mistakes. I mean, even months later, we were still taking stupid risks, of course, which can't happen today with, you know, risk assessment and this sort of thing. So we didn't learn from our mistakes, really. I remember one day with Nev, we'd been with the dog team going around Signy and Moe Island. We were coming back with the dog team. And near Goulet, where Roger's grave was, and we were looking at the dogs, and the sea ice was literally bending under the dogs. So we had this big arc, we kept the dogs going, and they got onto terra firma before we all went in, just up to our ankles, and we weren't far from base to go back and change. So, you know, we didn't learn. You take risks, we used to, we can't do it now, of course, it's different days.
You went to Roger's funeral, effectively, didn't you, I think?
No, I wasn't there for when he died. They had a memorial service for him the following summer,
right.
And I was there then.
Right.
But I wasn't there when it happened.
When the protector came in, and
yes,
and the padre,
took
the service, and I read a few lessons, and that was a good 12 months later, wasn't it? After
it must have been
after
that was the first vicar on base, effectively.
Yes,
of the protector, he was on the protector. Just came ashore to do the service, and put up the cross. And
so there was 12 months of just an unmarked grave. Source.
We made a cross. And ironically, on Admiralty Bay, this Dennis Tinker Bell actually made the coffin for Alan Sharman. Ironic, isn't it, that he would die, you know, just 2 months later. Mm. So we did, we made a homemade cross. Derek Clark, I think, did it, didn't he? And ran them on. So we had a temporary rest in peace, Roger Filer, for about 8-9 months till the protector came in with the official cross, which came down to the stores in the following November.
So the cross had been made back
Yes, made in the, yes.
Right.
That's still there.
That's still there. You saw it last year.
I saw it last November. Mm. Yeah.
Well, sort of, tell me about Roger. Tell me about what he was like, Roger Filer.
He was a great lad. I mean, Nev came down, didn't you, on the John Briscoe with Roger?
No, I didn't.
You didn't really meet him then?
Well, I met him only for a few days when I was coming from South Shetlands, going to South Georgia. But I knew I was going back to Sydney. The ship was going there, so I left most of my gear. Yeah. And I met him then. And then only less than 2 months later, this accident happened.
Yes, well,
I didn't come back to
I had a month with Roger before he died, and he was also a Swansea boy. He'd gone through Swansea geography and Swansea botany, and he was a great character. And what was a nice touch when we all got back, Derek Clark, who made the first cross for Roger's grave, he married Roger's sister, Anne Filer, and they're still married to this day, living in Keswick. And
so they met as a result of
this? Yeah. We all went round to see, when we got back, we went to see the parents and take, you know, memories and stories which they clung to, really. And Derek did the same and met Anne, and they fell in love, and they're still married all these years later, which is a nice, nice touch, really.
So we were talking about the Sheathfield work you were trying to do. What sort of work had Roger been doing, and what sort of work did you do on the Sheathfields?
Yeah. Well, basically, I mean, it's an odd bird. It's not like other birds, so nothing much was known about it.
Well, why is it odd?
Well, it's the only bird in Antarctica without webbed feet, for a start. But it's also quite a character, and it's around the base all the time, or around penguin colonies and whatever. But Roger had obviously started to just describe the basic ecology of this species, because the penguins were the ones that were done first, clearly. So he'd already identified the nests, because they're territorial, and they're spread around the penguin colony, and they sort of steal from the penguins. They mug the penguins for their krill and so on. So he'd marked the nests and had started to, well, he'd put plastic rings and metal rings on most of the breeders. And that was what he was doing, I think, during that season.
Yes, and some were recovered as far away as Chile and New Zealand, weren't they? Do you remember?
Well, no, Sheathfield doesn't get to New Zealand, but it does go to South America.
South America.
Yeah, it goes up and down, whereas the petrels go round.
Go round and round.
So it's capies and snowies and so on that go round. But so basically, that was the first thing that needed doing. So I spent the summer, I got relieved of my base duties, to actually go around just identifying, counting, marking eggs and so on, weighing them, the chicks and whatever, just to get an idea of the basic biology of this thing. And that was the first paper based on that. Since then, that led to quite a few other things which were odd about them, like their parasites, for example. You know, because they're an odd bird. It's really a land bird. All the others are seabirds. So that was what started that.
And Nev's obsessed with them now. He's formed a Sheathfield Appreciation Society in the last few years.
Well, no, it's actually called, the name nowadays, the preferred, is the Snowy Sheathbill. It's probably an American.
The Snowy Sheathbill, yeah. So oh, it's yes, the Snowy it's a worldwide association.
Snowy Sheathbill Society, the SSBS. Website, yes, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely.
See, we've both been cruising for the last 10 years, lecturing on Marco Polo and Saga Rose, Saga Ruby. We're going down again on the Saga Ruby in February, which is nice to go back together. And so he's collected characters from the Marco Polo from all around the world to join this sort of society. And have an AGM every year.
Well, we have to have a constitution and an AGM, like any society of note, of course, has. The trouble is now that we're rather spread out onto other ships, so it's going to have to be an electronic AGM in the future.
But the dirty little bird, I mean, Nev's obsessed with them, but they're great little characters, but they're the scavenger. They clean up the rookery. They take all the muck, don't they? They are on the eggs and chicks and so on. So they really are an interesting little bird. But Nev's got this obsession he has for 40-odd years now, I think, with the snowy sheathbill. Mm.
And would they stay on Cygni all year round?
No, they migrate across the Drake Passage to South America. But they breed down south and then go to winter in South America. But they do move around sometimes up and down the peninsula. They might not go across. Now, this is something that maybe might be happening now, with food possibly now becoming available in winter, because some used to stay around the bases.
Yeah.
Now, that was in the day when we just used to throw the garbage out.
we weren't very green in those days, were
no,
we?
All the rubbish was thrown out. We had a place called Gash Cove. So that was a great place for them. But they also, of course, were feeding off the dog spans. We had dogs in those days. You fed them with seal meat, so they were morsels, these things. So some of them stayed with us.
All year round?
Yeah, but our breeders didn't. So I think that the whole lot were moving north, you know. And some of these that we had in the winter had come from further south. But our breeders weren't around because the rings, you know, would identify them.
So the very existence of man on Sydney changed the pattern of life for some of the sheathgills?
It almost certainly did for some of them, yes. Mm. And but you also got gulls around.
Yeah,
there were gulls standing around as well.
In winter?
In winter, yeah.
Skuas? I can't remember.
Skuas used to be more sort of, they would move off
salt. Yeah, certainly gulls and sheathgills on the gash and the garbage.
So you almost had a responsibility to make sure that some food was thrown away.
Well, we don't think we looked at it like that. But on the other hand, the sheathbills are very, very sort of practical. You know, they'd go for anything. If you went for a walk down the beach with a bog roll under your arm, they'd be following you.
Yeah.
Why would you go for a walk down the beach with a bog roll?
Well,
yeah. Now, there's another story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if it's a lousy day, you didn't. You actually braved. Well. The toilet facilities were inside the hut, and basically it was like the old-fashioned thing. Was it just two holes?
It were two-seaters.
But I don't think I ever actually was in there with somebody else. But it was bitterly cold down that end. We didn't have any heating there or whatever. And we at Sydney, actually, we had an additional toilet down the bottom of the garden.
All felt line, it was. Yeah.
Just down on the beach.
Sort of magazines,
put up. Magazines and
no heating in there, but it was quite pleasant.
Yeah, but the thing that I found was odd, when you opened the door, it had a curtain of canvas.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it was cold, that thing was frozen virtually solid, so you had to sort of, you know, get your way in there. And you're out of the wind and you can think in peace. But if it was a nice day...
Yes, you go down the beach on the sea ice.
Just went down the beach.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble was with these latrines, they had huge doors to take out the trays, the urine trays and so on. And, of course, if the trap door was facing the prevailing wind, you'd be sitting on the seat with trying to get your toilet paper down between your legs. That would be flying all over the place. And I had a little story because I was one of the first people to change. We used to use tin cans, which we had dried veg and sugar and so on, and we used these tin cans so high, and it was
below the drop.
Wasn't much of a drop, of a foot or so.
You had to watch where you didn't touch it, though.
Yeah, and so I was. It's normally the gash hand is job to take with the excreta away, and we were using these tin cans, and of course they were a problem. We dumped them on the sea ice, hoping they'd float away towards South America to make it more fertile or something. But it invariably get blown back onto the beach, and there'd be tins and rubbish everywhere. So Derek Gibbs, I think it was, devised a new system. Rather than use sort of tin cans, we'd have sort of biodegradable cardboard with a polythene inner, you see. And they're much bigger, so it can take 10 days of accumulation rather than, you know, 4 or 5 days. So we put one of these in, and I was Joe Blogg, the first person, you know, to empty this new experimental bag. So I opened this trap door, and it wasn't at Sydney, Admiralty Bay, but I took out this big bag, tied a topper, put it on my shoulder, and I was walking down to the sea ice, and I heard this dreadful ripping sound. And the whole thing opened and ripped. Yes, that's my Semper in Excreta, I think. It's a very nice sort of motto for Sydney Island. Yeah. Yes, Semper in Excreta. Always in Excreta. It's on the photographs.
Yes, it's on the photographs, or it's on the menus or whatever. Yeah.
Always in Excreta. Always in Excreta. And this is a prime example.
But you were hinting there that it wasn't advisable to let your nether regions touch the tin.
Oh, absolutely, because as it says, in the winter there's no heating there at all, so it was really very cold. And if you touched it, you freeze to it, you know. So they not only were these cans cold and therefore not to be touched, but they were also very jagged because we used to open them with a great big
spong thing, can opener.
So it was pretty jagged and bent back. But if you did touch it, you did freeze to it. So you didn't hang very low if you could possibly help it.
Well, at -5, though, in that little latrine, you didn't hang very low, did you? You know, but all men are equal, aren't they, at -5, I think. So,
the whole process things would contract. It was fraught with danger. That sounds very primitive. You were there in the early 60s. What advances were made in your time there? Either technological, or indeed in terms of comfort, shall we say?
Nothing. I mean, when we went down there, we had no training, apart from the meteorology, we had no training whatsoever. Actually, we wanted to become base leader. You were the dentist and the doctor and the magistrate and so on. We had no training in first aid, no. Mountaineering, crevasse rescue, nothing at all. We did our trip to Stanmore to the Air Ministry, did our little short course there, and then all headed south, as green as can be, down to the Antarctic. And we were very lucky sometimes to get away with things we did, because we had no training whatsoever.
Well, I describe it really as we were there in the period between the heroic era,
yeah,
you know, and the modern era,
yeah,
and we were somewhere in between,
yeah,
with really very poor preparation.
Yeah.
Nowadays,
it's so
now,
different.
You know,
I mean, the biggest change was that toilet arrangement, swapping the tin can for this,
didn't
you know,
work, didn't
yeah, this bag.
Was
I mean, that was the technology nowadays, because we still had the same tinned and dried food. We lived off the land, we hate to say that today, but we did. We killed seals and penguins, for the dogs mostly, but also for ourselves. We collected, 1,500 penguin eggs to keep over the winter in boxes of flour. To eat omelette. When they first came back, we'd about 10 a day, wouldn't we, when they first came back? It was basic. And even the hut itself was basic. I mean, the chairs were these dreadful sort of utility things which cut your back in half, really. We had in the hut in Signy, we had three permanent fires, didn't we? The hut was about 90 feet long, and we had a fire in the lounge, in the kitchen, obviously, and one in the workshop bathroom for washing water. And the rest of the hut was au naturel, really.
We did have a stove in the bunk room, but we never used
it. No, we never used it.
Didn't bother.
We had to watch the coal as well. I mean, we didn't have a lot of spare coal. And so, I was reading my diary last week, we got down to minus 12, I think, in the bunker room on one occasion.
Yeah.
So, it was pretty basic.
Would you sleep in minus 12?
Yes, we had sleeping bags on the, good sleeping bags, didn't we, on the bunks.
I never used a sleeping bag on
my
bunk.
I
just had sheets and blankets. But also, you put your clothes on. I mean, I know I used to sort of, you know, take my sweater and shirt off together, you know, and leave them on the top.
Yeah, and the rug,
so
off, the rug off the floor as well.
They had
a
bit of the heat from my body, so you can just put them all back again as you got out of bed.
And we had a mobile hot water bottle, a cat. We had a little, we had a ginger Tom there, and he was a useful little bed warmer.
But we couldn't all share it.
No, to pass him down the line, you know, yeah. The last person was stuck with him for the night.
literally, Cap used to do the...
Nev can't remember this, but it must have been before he came down, but I remember passing the cat down the bunk room to warm the sheets.
Mm. What was the cat's name?
Tiddles, or Gin. Photographs around of Gin.
Yeah.
Yes, and Tiddles. Mm.
And culinary skills, were they advanced in 1961 in Sydney?
We all did our fair share of cooking. We had the wonderful cookbook, Jerry Cutland's Fit for a Fid, How to Cook Seal and Penguin and Shag and goodness knows what.
And Hungarian goulash and exotic things that I'd never heard of.
Yeah, we used to make.
Modified suitably for the kind of dried and canned stuff that we had. Because we had no meat.
And seals and penguins. I'm sure the recipe for penguin faggots. we lived off the land in the summer, and then we were on the tinned and dried stuff for the rest of the year, which was a bit tedious. But Signy always had the odd penguin and seal, didn't it, right through the year, really? Something
it could pop up.
A lost soul would appear, and we'd bop it straight away for either ourselves or the dogs. Because on Admiralty Bay, we had over 50 huskies. On Signy, we had about 18?
Yeah, something like that.
And we lost quite a few of those with that dreaded
disease
didn't we?
What was that?
God, it's like a throat cancer, wasn't it?
Well,
it's a horrible thing.
It didn't really come to the sort of the bottom of it, because they had the main symptom seemed to be a large fluid
filled growth,
growth
underneath the chin.
And we got on to the doctor who was in Hope Bay on the radio and sort of asked him about it. So he came back and he thought it was something called erysipelas. I had no idea what that was about. As I said, we had no first aid training formally, but I'd done a bit of St John's Ambulance and whatever. And being a biologist, I suppose I was the nearest.
Well, you were the dentist, weren't you?
Well, I tried filling his teeth, and I think the record was about three days.
It was zinc oxide. Oil of cloves and zinc oxide were the temporary fillings, and they've tried to fill my teeth, but didn't last long.
But also I got on to actually trying to do some minor surgery, involved with minor surgery on people, but also on the dogs. So I was just injecting them and whatever. And we never really got to the end of it, to the bottom of it. And I used to have a look at them. I opened them up and see what was there. And we couldn't see anything obvious as a growth or whatever, but we lost several. Only one survived.
Yeah, the thought was perhaps from the elephant seal,
It was thought that there might be something like that.
I'm sure we sent organs all around the world to vets, and they couldn't get to the bottom of it.
In the end, of course, dogs were taken away. In case they gave something to the seals, but in fact, it might have been working the other way around.
I don't know.
We talked a bit about the work you were doing. Did you feel at the time it was vital work? And looking back on it 45 years later, does it still feel as though the work you were doing was vital? Or was it just something you did because you were there?
Well, I suppose it was a means of getting to the Antarctic to become a Met observer. But I think we soon realised that meteorology was perhaps one of the most important relevant sciences, because of forecasting for ships and aircraft in the Southern Ocean. So I always took the Met seriously, and I felt it was... And the climate record, of course, you're building up a record which went for nearly 50 years of climate data, because when we were down there, it was the coldest on record. Well, much of a record, but it was very cold in the 50s and the 60s, long before the current warming trend. And so I thought that, you know, as a climatologist, basically, it was so worthwhile to start building up a continuous climate record. And then the use of data for forecasts was also very important. And I did a glaciology project as a hobby, really, but it got me an MSc at the end of the day. And we took our hobbies seriously, didn't we, really? Because we all still felt they were worthwhile.
What was the glaciology project? What were you trying to do?
Looking at the Orwell Glacier, really, looking at its mass balance, the balance between accumulation and ablation in terms of atmospheric controls. And even in those days, it was a very sick glacier. It was losing more than it was going. It was just about holding its own above the fern line.
It was called...
The Orwell Glacier. Orwell. You can see now from looking at the maps on here how it has shrunk in the last sort of 50 years. And then again, I mean, if you believe in global warming and you worry about the loss of Antarctic ice and rising sea levels. So I, in a way, in 1961, sort of pioneered a study. Although Derek Mayling, my mentor, really, who lectured to me and gave me his diaries and so on. He'd done some glaciology in 1948, so I was continuing almost 12 years, 13 years later. Yeah, we all felt the work was worthwhile.
So, one second there. Have you spotted then, already in the early 60s, the embryonic changes that we now describe as being global warming? Had it decreased from 48 to 61, for example?
No, it was remarkably static. In fact, it had got progressively colder over those 10 years. 1961, I think. In my memory, we went down to minus 35 on Cygni. Yes. And, you know, at times you were colder than bases well inside the Antarctic Circle. You know, here we are 60 degrees south on the mouth of the Weddell Sea, this big ice reservoir. So no, there were no signs of we were still in a cooling trend, which went on till the 70s, really, and then it sort of flipped back into a warming trend. But the Orwell Glacier, even during this time of abnormal cold, was still marginally healthy. It was didn't have a great deal of accumulation over ablation even then. So looking
back on it and knowing what we now know, are you now suspicious that it was already beginning to?
No, I made a forecast. I reckon that glacier would go in 60 years. I haven't been back never the last year, But it certainly has got a great deal smaller in the last sort of 20, 30 years. But no, at that time, we were in a cooling trend, which continued all around the world until the 70s, so we didn't...
But despite, just to push the point home, despite the cooling trend, you were forecasting it was going to get smaller.
Yes, because its mass balance was very, very iffy. It was slightly in positive mass balance, which meant that it was very close to equilibrium.
Right.
Because remember, with a glacier, it's not just melting, it's the nourishment as well, and that maintains the balance. So it looked pretty vulnerable in 1961, and has been proved in the last 20 years.
Actually, just as a reminder, at that time we were being predicted that we're entering a mini ice age.
Yeah.
It was only that far back.
We were. Since then. Yeah.
Yes, about whether the work was worthwhile or whatever. I think there were two aspects to it. I really felt that it was important to have reports and records of the climate down there because of the effect it obviously has on other parts of the world, not necessarily on this country directly, but it did obviously in the Southern Oceans. And of course, all this arose out of Operation Tabarin during the war, the Second World War. So I realised that this was quite important. But one of the big differences between then and now, with respect, is in our days, FIDS ran maybe 10 bases.
Yeah.
Most of them with only 5, which is the smallest complement, which of course has problems of the safety and doing everything and whatever we're talking about. Because you needed to have them spread around to be able to get a picture of what was happening, weather systems. But now, of course, none of that is sort of really necessary. The spread isn't necessary because they're doing it from satellites. So the whole place has changed. I mean, one, say our very basic complement were 3 Met men, a radio op and a diesel mechanic. The 3 Met men were doing other things on the side. Mm. Now, those were the basic. That was what we had at Sydney.
Yeah.
Now, on some of the other bases, they were bigger. The ones that were doing a lot of geology and surveying, this was a descriptive face. We were describing things.
Mm.
Now, it's investigating, understanding, and looking at the way the whole systems operate and link with one another. So now, you have a very small number of bases with many more people on. So it's quite different.
Once the NERC took over from the Crown agents, it became much more scientific, to be honest. I mean, we did some good basic science, but it was more our good luck and judgment rather than any sort of FIDS policy. I mean, I went down with FIDS, there were 11 or 12 bases, and it was essentially still political. We were still, you know, waving the Union Jack.
Being there.
This was before the Antarctic Treaty, and the claims by Argentina and Chile were relevant and potent. And as base leader, I think I had 150 Union Jacks up the loft, you know. I always had a Union Jack to fly.
Did you really?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
So FIDS really, run by the Crown agents, were mostly exiles from Africa. And they had some weird ideas about drink. Only one can of beer a week, and... the story goes that on a 6-man base there should only be 5 chairs. There's always somebody up and earning his money. You know. And these were exiled from Kenya and Uganda especially, running the Crown agents in Milbank, running FIDS, and Bunny Fuchs was away on the TAE. So I think the science in those days was Mickey Mouse, I suppose, to be honest. But we did the best we could under the circumstances, and we did some pretty good work. But once NERC took over in the 60s, it became, and meteorologists did meteorology, not any old sort of Tom, Dick or Harry, it certainly, the science became much more sophisticated. Much more sophisticated.
Would not have recognised the global significance of, as it turned out, what was happening. Because the ozone depletion was first noticed by a guy operating virtually under the old system. And, you know, and the Americans were missing it because they were using fancy technology. And he was doing it with the old-fashioned way. And he obviously recorded this. Now, people, that really was a pretty serious wake-up to a lot of people, because if CFCs were causing it, the CFCs were used mostly in the developed world, in the Northern Hemisphere. And this was... developing this thing down there. So
it was done on a shoestring, wasn't it?
It was.
A little spectrometer on the Argentine island. Yeah.
In the same way as these long-term records of, say, for example, plankton in the seas have suddenly have a new significance because of global warming. So you never know. I mean, it was basically basic science, not applied science, but there was always what if somebody finds coal, oil, gas, that's still there.
Yeah.
I mean, even though we've got the Antarctic Treaty signed up to by 46 countries or something now, people are still concerned that what if one of them wants to or starts, what do we do then? So now it's all become much bigger, much more global. And much more, actually, I think a lot of people, the people come on these cruise ships, for example, a lot of those are really concerned about these sorts of aspects. And we get good discussions going with them about, you know, how do you deal with it?
One more question, then we'll talk about the cruise ship era. Your work on the sheath bills, has it ever been surpassed?
I don't think anybody wanted to, There are only two species of sheath bill. One is in the islands south of in the Pacific Ocean. That's Chionis minor. That's a sort of smaller black faced sheath bill. There are several subspecies there, and some of the people from South Africa there have been doing work on them. The rest is down our way, and there hasn't been a lot done. There's been some work done. But it depends what you mean by, you know, surpass its value and whatever. So, and who wants to know? Well, I rather fancy knowing, and quite a few of the people are quite interested. The birdie people are interested. But only some of them, they don't seem to like the bird's habits. It's not a dirty bird. It's immaculately clean.
It's a scavenger.
It just has some dirty habits, that's all.
Dirty habits. Well, we all have, probably.
How did the presumably, you left Bass or Fids and went off and did other things.
Yes.
What did you do?
I left in 62. I taught school in Holland, an English school in The Hague for 2 years. Then went to Australia, Armidale, University of New England, to do my PhD. Then Massey University in New Zealand for 2 years. And University of Guelph in Canada, University of Fiji for a year. So I was globetrotting before getting back to University of Reading in 1974. And I retired from there in 1999.
As a biologist?
As a climatologist.
Climatologist.
Yeah, climatologist.
And Nev?
Well, I went back and I was planning to go into teaching because I had already prepared for it before I went down. But in fact, I was given an offer of an opportunity to go back to my old university college at Bangor to be a demonstrator and do my PhD at the same time. That was more attractive. So I did that. Now, that gave me a PhD, and I ended up getting my first academic job at the University of Hull in zoology, and I'm virtually still there.
But you're retired officially.
I have retired now, officially.
Tell me how the cruise ships began for you two. What happened?
Well,
is this something you did together from the very beginning?
I'm 10 years into cruising now. In 1997, the Geography Club at Reading University, run by the students, invited a speaker from the Scott Polar to lecture on Antarctic tourism, Bernard Stonehouse, a well-known biologist. So Bernard came down and gave his lecture, and we were having a drink of coffee in the common room, and I said, "You lucky devil, how do you manage?" He said, "Oh, it's easy, just write to a few shipping companies, they're always looking out for new lecturers." So I wrote to Orient Lines, and the reply came back immediately from the leader, Nigel Sitwell, saying, "Yes, we're looking for someone like you to do the geology and the meteorology, climatology and life and work and so on." So I started on the Marco Polo in 1997. And we've been friends for many years, and so the time came when they've was going to go down as my guest on the Marco Polo. He was going to pay his airfare, and he's $50 a day, whatever it is, and we'd sign him up as my guest. 2 months before he was due to guest with me, one of the biologists pulled out due to family problems. And I said to Nigel, "I've got the ideal man for you." And that's how... When was that, Nev? Was 5 years ago?
Five years ago.
Yeah. That's when Nev started. So that year, he wasn't my guest. We actually did 6 cruises together and went back to Antarctic for the first time for over 40 years. Yeah. And then I left the Marco Polo to go on to the Saga Rose, and I persuaded the leader to take Nev off the Marco Polo, and he's coming down with me on the Ruby, Saga Ruby, in February. So it'd be great to go.
Go back
south again to Oldholmes.
It's next year. Mm. We're going back on the same ship next year.
Next year.
But the 4 years in the middle, we've been on different ships.
We did cruise once together, six cruises.
How is it going south again?
Oh, it's great. I love it.
Yeah,
it's been a tremendous bonus, really, for both of us.
It's obviously different. You know, it can't be the same. Because clearly, some things of what dominated the ones 2 years down there.
Yeah.
It's obviously going to be the people you were with and the dogs. But obviously the place. But the people, the dogs and things are completely different now. Okay, there's a good camaraderie amongst the team of lecturers and so on. The place, of course, is still there, but you've got much more comfort because these ships are much bigger than the ones that we were on. I actually find it really quite rewarding trying to talk to people about this place and telling them about it, because it's the effect they have on. Because there's one of the books, it's a quote that I usually use actually when I'm talking to them about this thing, is that people who go to the Antarctic find that this experience changes their lives. Now, I'm sure it does, and getting them to get the most out of it, because they're not all knowing where they are, let alone what they're supposed to be doing there. Some of the comments are
unbelievable.
Some of them are just ticking, the continents away. Yeah. See, you can't expect everybody to like what I like about the place. Birds or seals and things. Some of them know exactly what they're looking for. They've done their homework. Others are just on a holiday and it's just somewhere different. Mm. So you've got to try.
It doesn't bother us, though. People say, shouldn't the Antarctic be for explorers and people who are prepared to suffer and deprivation and so on? And I say, no, these people are becoming ambassadors of the Antarctic. Because when you went down, you went to Margaret Bay, and I'm sure you were turned on immensely. And they can go back home. They might boast to their neighbours about the seventh continent. But they're also going to promote the Antarctic and green issues and so on. And I just enjoy sharing the place with and being able to help and explain things to them, the rocks or the biology or whatever it is. To me, I get a thrill out of that.
Yeah. So you slipped in the phrase, some of the comments are amazing. Or
ridiculous. Oh, yes. I mean, the classic one, really, the Americans are. They go to the lectures, but some of them are sick of that chair. They're all rich business executive, they've all been up high in industry and so on. And I remember at Chinstrap Rookery at Half Moon Island, one of the Americans looking at the chinstrap saying, well, when do these birds fly away from here? And he'd been to all the lectures on penguins and birds, we get a dossier, don't we?
We do tend. Quotes. Somebody's got the job of accumulating.
Passenger quotes,
How far south do you go with these trips?
Oh, well, on the Marco Polo, my first season, we went down to the Ross Sea and we did the Huts of Scott and Shackleton at McMurdo, which was fantastic. But the Marco Polo stopped doing that in the early... I think the 2000 millennium one was the last Ross Sea on the Marco Polo. So it's the peninsula and the islands, basically. We go down as far as Petermann or the Argentine islands, the old Base F, it's Base F. But it's the old haunts, it's Deception or Half Moon and Paradise and Port Lockroy and Lemaire, Kodak Gap.
You should go down the Lemaire and turn around most of the time, but we don't make the Antarctic Circle, which obviously upsets a few people.
Yeah, it does.
But
so close.
I think we're usually 62-something.
Yeah. Well, this year we're going to land at Petermann on the Saga Ruby.
That's right, yes.
The boats don't make the Antarctic Circle because it takes extra days and the economy changes. Tickets get too expensive.
They say that, and for what it's worth, yes, to cross a line. I mean, it is. Yeah. As you go beyond 63, the pack ice does, even today, the climate change and so on, the pack ice does become much more serious for these cruise ships. And these cruise ships are, on the whole, luxury liners, aren't they? The Marco Polo, it's a four-star cruise ship, and the Saga, Rosa and Ruby are as well.
We don't normally, we don't always, I should say, get through the Le Maire Channel anyway. So it's got an itinerary. These ships are on a virtually a 12-month itinerary, so they can't afford to be held up. So this is really why I don't think they go any further than they can almost guarantee.
And they can't pack it in, because I think last year, well, there were 30-odd cruise ships working on it, which one. So it's big business arranging for ships not to be there, other ships are there. So they've got to really keep moving and don't hang around, you know, south of Le Maire for long to get back up to Half Moon or the South Shetland and the South Georgia. So it's a big business these days.
It's getting quite difficult to time.
You're 100% behind all this. There's nothing inside you deep down which says it's a shame that the Antarctic is becoming a tourist venue.
No, we're lucky because the ships we are on, they certainly control the passengers ashore. I mean, in all my 10 years, I mean, I've always been impressed with the way that they keep them off the breeding penguins and so on. As this experience at Port Lockroy many years ago, we were there with our cones and our ropes and all the penguin police, keeping them off the penguins. And a yacht came in with four people. And they scrambled, remember? Scrambled through the penguins, sitting there, you know, holding a Gen 2 penguin for a photograph. And passengers kept saying, well, you know, what's going on? You know, why aren't they controlled by IATA? But there's no expedition team to organise
them. Well, I started being very sceptical about it all. I wasn't really thinking that it was a good idea. But I decided to take Russ's offer at that stage to just go and see it once more. But I was really very impressed with the way the ship actually did work, because to get 500 people on shore in a place like that, is, I thought, how the hell can they do it?
It's big business. They
operate this shuttle service, and each passenger is only ashore for 1 hour normally when you've got that number of people. Smaller ships, maybe 80 to 100, they can actually land them all at one time. They can maybe do two or three landings per day. Now, you know, it's a balancing up of these things. I still think it is risky, but I can't really feel that I should deny anybody else the experience that I've enjoyed so much, seeing a place like that.
It is risky, though.
It is risky. There are risks. Obviously, that we had a ship hauled in Deception this last year.
And Marco Polo at Half Moon Island. We were on board when we hit a reef, put a hole in the hull. Luckily, we had an inner skin as well, but it was right next to the fuel tank, so what would have been a disaster there. So that is the worry, I suppose, of uncharted waters or just ships blown onto reefs or rocks and so on, and oil pollution. But touch wood,
this is where this management of Antarctica comes in, you see, because it is, firstly, the tourism is better controlled than most tourism is in areas not necessarily like that, actually. It is better controlled. The system, now, it's the Antarctic Treaty system, but there's also IATO, of which some of the ships that we were on were not members of. Now, IATO is a voluntary thing anyway amongst themselves. So I can't really see that I can put my weight behind them. For example, they used to say that ships with more than 100 should not be going down there, that kind of thing. Mm. Now they've changed their numbers to up to 500. Now, why have they done that? Mm. Well, because their own membership are putting pressure on it. Mm. Now, if their system is controlling, and it's going to become even more controlled, I'm sure it has to be, because there are only a few places which are well charted, which are available for ships to go to see what passengers want to see, like proximity to penguins and all that kind of stuff, and that they all have to abide by the rules. You know, and we do this by, we take cones, ashore, traffic cones, and put them down there, and ropes and things. So if we see anybody stepping over them, you know, we can call them back, and that's part of our role. When we're on shore, that's what one of the things we do. We're the penguin police, they reckon.
So you're introducing the traffic cones to the Antarctic?
The traffic cones.
We are, but we take them back.
We take them back and we wash them
absolutely
and take them back.
Absolutely everything has to go back.
One more thing from there, if I may. You made it back to Sydney last year?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was a small ship which was able to get in November, which was a surprise to us anyway. But there were two of us on board who'd wintered there. This is Fergus O'Gorman and myself. The rest, the party, it was a group of Irish people. We landed, we visited the base and so on, and we had asked whether we could possibly visit Gourdlay, because just to see the grave, and also I'd built a hut there that summer that I was there, and I'd lived in this hut, and it was still standing. This is 40-odd years afterwards, and I thought I'd like to see it. Well, when I got on shore, the base, they said, well, it's a good thing you've come now, he said, because we're putting two new huts up this year, and yours is being demolished. So we got permission anyway. It was a good day and everything, so the ship allowed us, a Zodiac, with a couple of crew, just to pop us down there for half an hour. And so we had a quick visit there. It really was quite moving, actually, because, first of all, the grave was exactly, to my mind, as it was, even the lichens and things on the rocks, because these guys who had put it together had actually found flat rocks and so on, you know, which I remembered at the time admiring. And they're still there. The cross was still there in good condition. Then the huts are a bit further away, and the penguins are still nesting around there. But I couldn't for the life of me really plot or remember how many of them there are, whether they were the same numbers. But the same two species were there, the dollies and chinstraps. Mm. So it was really, you know, sort of moving, but it was quick, and it was really nice to be.
Did you go inside the base itself?
Yes. Yes.
And that was completely different?
This is Mark III. Because our hut was, what do we call it?
Tonsberg
House.
That's gone.
Then they had what locally, I gather, was called the Plastic Palace.
Yeah.
And that's now gone. And there's another one, which is that's a Mark III. Since our time, there was one before us, from looking at some of the photographs.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yes, we had a look around. We met the support staff that were there, because there were a couple of scientists around, but they were out somewhere doing field work. But they'd only been there a week, because it's a summer only now.
Mm, yeah.
So they were busy just getting the base going and operating at that time. But it was nice to see them. They had good, comfortable conditions and central heating and things, which we didn't have.
Would you have liked to have stayed?
I'd love to have stayed there for the summer, yes. Yeah, it would have been nice, actually, but not on.
Somebody said I had to ask you about the loo door.
Ah, now then, that's my wife mentioned this too.
Yes.
Well, she got it wrong. She's heard some of these stories, you see. But in fact, she got it wrong. She mentioned this to me yesterday, and I said, you got it wrong. It was the coal house door, which we borrowed for 40 odd years.
from the coal house
in the hut, in the base hut, to put on the door as a door for the huts that I built at Gourdlay. There were two of us who were doing this, you see, Derek and I, and Russ and a couple of others had helped enormously by taking all this stuff over the sea ice to Gourdlay. And then we went over there in October and built this thing. But we didn't have proper timbers and things. It was cobbled up. And to get a decent piece that would make a door, we had to...
Even borrowed some of my glaciology stakes, didn't
well,
you?
Well, yeah. The frame.
The
Russ's glaciology stakes.
Yeah.
And we only had a few bits of hardboard and 3-ply to be walls, but we had enough sort of tongue and groove to just, I think we made a floor and the roof from that. But the base of the whole thing are two balks of timber that were the old plan. The old whaling plan in
the jetty
factory cove.
Yeah.
We took two of those. Mm. We borrowed the door, but it still hasn't got back. But there we are.
No.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Our pleasure.
Well,
thank you.
Full, Chris.